Well, good morning. Welcome to church or back to church or something like that. Well, so sorry that the Hordes aren't able to be with us in... Well, they're kind of here in person, but they're in body. There you are. Anyway, we're sorry, but glad that you have joined us by way of the electrons. Well, have you had a good week? Pretty good. Yeah, that's good.
So far, I just started.
Just started, first day, yeah. Well, we kind of review on Sunday, though, don't we? Although we're studying prophecy, so I guess we're looking to the future, too. Isaiah chapter 16 today. Last week we read the first chapter that begins the burden of Moab that Isaiah had. And this is a continuation of that in chapter 16. One of the challenges of prophecy is always wrapping your brain around where it is that the prophet is coming from. What sort of angle, what kind of voice, who's doing the speaking. And sometimes that's very difficult to do. But we have these words here in verse 1 of chapter 16. Send the lamb to the ruler of the land. From Selah, by way of the desert, to the mount of the daughter of Zion. Okay, so what we'll see unfolding in this chapter is Isaiah is portraying perhaps an event that actually happened, perhaps something that he envisions as a possibility, but there is, as it were, an embassy sent from the land of Moab to the land of Judah looking for assistance in dire times. So the Moabites here are sending a lamb as a tribute, as a gift to the Judahites, looking for help in this time of deep trouble that Isaiah is describing. He says, like fleeing birds, like a scattered nest, so are the daughters of Moab at the fords of the Arnon. Okay. If you've ever had the privilege of spending some time in the out-of-doors, walking around in the woods, you can envision this picture here, like fleeing birds. If you've ever scattered a covey of quail, but all of a sudden you'll be walking along and boo, they come up flying every which direction, helter-skelter, trying to get away. And so then here too, this picture of a scattered nest. The nest had been the safe habitat for the bird, and some kind of varmint or some varmint in the form of a person comes along and just scatters the nest, and the birds are everywhere trying to escape. It's quite a figurative picture. At the fords of the Arnon. Now, where's the Arnon? Ever so often, I like to take a look at geography. It helps you connect better with Scripture to understand in your mind where things are happening. And I have a map here of the Holy Land, as we call it, which with markings which show the early tribes. And we see Moab down here, and the Arnon River is just on its northern border. At one time, anyway, a border between it and Reuben. Now, I don't know about you, but when I think about this part of the world, especially this side of the Dead Sea, what kind of image comes to your mind? What's over there?
Rocks and desert.
Yeah. And so this river thing, like, what can that look like? So I looked it up. Fortunately, we live in a day where we can make quick trips across vast distances with just a few clicks of the mouse. It's not called the Arnon River anymore. But it still exists. Okay, so we see here that this is the Dead Sea, or what's left of it. It's beginning to dry up some. In a world where water is so precious, you don't let much of it run into a salty hole. And so this lower area here is what would be known in Bible times as the Arnon River. And you can see here there's a great delta where over the years stuff has washed out into the Dead Sea. So there has been some water there at some point. But we have some pictures here that give us an idea of what it might look like now. And so, lo and behold, that's kind of pretty. Clear water running through a deep cut in the rock. Might be a nice place to hike. Yeah, the places people go. No, wouldn't be a good run, would it? I don't know if any of you saw the video clip that was recently posted of that rock face collapsing in, I think it was Brazil. It was a beautiful sight, something like this. And it was on a river, and there were a lot of people on vacation, and all of a sudden, the whole side of the cliff comes crashing down. It killed 8 or 10 people, I believe. So I sort of look at rocks like that differently now. You know, that fell sometime or another, and it could fall again. So do you really want to stand under it? But anyway.
Real life Jenga.
Yeah.
It looks like somebody was playing Tetris and didn't quite make it.
Would that be somewhat salty too? Does the saltiness not happen until the Dead Sea?
So, I mean, it would all be slightly salty because it's dissolving it out of the rocks, but it would be fresh water as far as we're concerned.
Probably float in it easily.
Right. No, it's not like the Dead Sea is a result of the evaporation of water over a long time. The salt doesn't evaporate, the water does, and so it concentrates after a while. But anyway, we can go all the way down here then to where that it dumps into the Red Sea. And I thought this was kind of interesting. If we go to Street View, there's not very many places in this part of the world where you can do Street View. But we find ourselves here in the middle of the bridge over the river, and if we look upstream, it's kind of shadowy and you can't really see that well, but if you come back and look downstream, you'll see that the water is all gone. They're not dumping any of it into the Dead Sea. It's all being taken off for uses of agriculture and human beings and whatnot. So it is a beautiful sight for a ways, but it stops there. Now, I suppose if there's a real big flood, there'll be something that gets in. But and this is one of the issues, if you're an environmentalist and concerned about keeping things the way they are, although nothing stays the way it is. But the fact that there's not water much at all running into the Dead Sea is a cause for protests and things. But it does seem like a bit of a waste just to dump it in a salty, briny hole. So they usually don't. This would be in modern-day Jordan. Anyway, pardon me?
They can't get fish out of it. They can't, I mean, there's no good use for it except to float.
Actually, there is a good use for it.
Salt.
Salt, right. You can mine the salt and sell it to people in America as a cosmetic enhancement. Yes, I was one time in a mall waiting on Rachel in Nashville, Tennessee, a long time ago, and there was this lady in there that was selling this cream.
Never look them in the eye.
And anyway, she was telling me that there's no chemicals in this at all. And I said, you know, water is a chemical, H2O. She thought a minute. She said, well, for most people, there's no chemicals in this. So she didn't sell me any, but it was an interesting conversation. So, yeah, there's actually a lot of chemicals. And in fact, I don't know what the composition of the salt in the Dead Sea is. It may be a real gold mine, so to speak, because lithium salts are now extremely valuable because of all the electrification we're trying to do of the world and the batteries that we make out of lithium. And so I haven't read anything, but I'm sure there's some lithium in it. And so it might be a motherlode, so to speak, of value, even though you can't eat it, except in small quantities.
And there's, you know, yes. I mean, there would be some rain occasionally,
right?
Over there, but as far as just maintaining the sea level of that, is it consistently just going down over time?
It'd be interesting to look up and see how the levels have changed, but I do know that in general it has gone down. I don't know on a trajectory how fast it's going or anything like that. Yes, that would be interesting to know.
From the map, it looked like there was a whole subdivision on that delta. Yeah.
Yes, as well as some agriculture, right? Some groves of... Yeah. I don't know if it's date palms or what they are. If we exit the street view here, get this going back north. There we are. So, it's mostly agriculture, I think. I saw over here somewhere there's a nature preserve. Yeah. So, yeah, it's... probably a pretty low budget thing, you know. It's not hard to preserve the desert if you just keep people out. At least you don't have to water it. Anyway, interesting part of the world, and one way to add interest to your Bible study is to get on Google Earth and check these places out, right? Okay, so back to the Bible. Isaiah here then pictures the daughters of Moab at the fords of the Arnon. And you can imagine that the fords of Arnon are few and far between. You saw the pictures, and you can go right on up the upstream from it, and it's all pretty much a deep chasm. There's not a lot of good places to get across if you're fleeing an enemy, especially. And so here in Isaiah's picturing of the Moabites, as it were, coming to Jerusalem, asking for refuge, This then is sort of the conversation that takes place. Give counsel, grant justice, make your shade like night at the height of noon. Okay, so you can imagine that in this part of the world, shade is a very valuable thing. Anything to escape the sun, at the height of noon especially. So it's a metaphor for protection, for relief. Your shade, make your shade like night at the height of noon. Shelter the outcasts. Do not reveal the fugitive. Let the outcasts of Moab sojourn among you. Be a shelter to them from the destroyer. Okay, so this is what the Moabites are saying to the Judites. The response then starts in the second half of this verse 4. When the oppressor is no more and destruction has ceased, and he who tramples underfoot has vanished from the land, then a throne will be established in steadfast love, and on it will sit in faithfulness in the tent of David, one who judges and seeks justice and is swift to do righteousness. Okay, so the request for help, request for shelter, is responded to with, yes, but then we will rule over you, essentially. The house of David will rule over the land. And so then the response back is first commented on by Isaiah. He says, we have heard of the pride of Moab, how pride he is, of his arrogance, his pride and his insolence. In his idle boasting, he is not right. So essentially, there's a refusal of terms on the basis of pride. We can't accept that, which in such dire circumstances is odd. Therefore, let Moab wail for Moab. Let everyone wail. Mourn, utterly stricken, for the raisin cakes of Kir-Haresheth. For the fields of Heshbon languish, and the vine of Sibmah. The lords of the nations have struck down its branch, which reached to Jazer and strayed to the desert. Its shoots spread abroad and passed over the sea. So, a description of a total destruction of the agriculture of the land. Raisin cakes, of course, would be like dried grapes. Apparently, there are parts of this land that are good for vineyards, even though you probably won't see much Midwestern corn there. Sometimes grapes grow in pretty difficult surroundings. And this depicts them being destroyed by this invasion. Now, verse 9 is interesting because essentially Isaiah is picturing God as being sorrowful for the suffering of the Moabites. Therefore, I weep with the weeping of Jazer for the vine of Sibmah. I drench you with my tears, O Heshbon and Alilah, for over your summer fruit and your harvest, the shout has ceased. And joy and gladness are taken away from the fruitful field. And in the vineyards, no songs are sung, no cheers are raised, no leader treads out wine in the presses, I have put an end to the shouting. Therefore, my inner parts moan like a lyre for Moab, and my inmost self for Kir Hareseth. And when Moab presents himself, when he worries himself on the high place, when he comes to his sanctuary to pray, he will not prevail. This is the word that the Lord spoke concerning Moab in the past. But now the Lord has spoken, saying, in 3 years, like the years of a hired worker, bless you, the glory of Moab will be brought into contempt. In spite of all his great multitude, and those who remain will be very few and feeble. Okay, so in 3 years, like the years of a hired worker, what does that say? Somebody who is hired by the hour tends to know what time it is, right? Just as a matter of fact, can I go yet, right? Their best timekeepers in the world are people that are watching the clock. And so this is a way of saying this is a precise time. It's not sometime in the future. It's 3 years as the years of the hired worker. And because the hired worker knows when they're up. Okay, so the burden of Isaiah for Moab. And one thing we begin to see, the prophets especially, is these various ways of expressing God's universal view. Yes, he has chosen Israel. Yes, he is particularly concerned about bringing forth the Messiah by means of cultivating that relationship. But he also is aware of and cares about the world around. There are ongoing expressions of the wider world looking to Zion, of coming to Zion, of bringing tribute to Zion, of worshiping the Lord there. And here we see an expression of God having a passion and a concern about the suffering of people outside of Israel. And so it's interesting to follow that line of thought through the prophets. He's not just God of the Jews. Any comments about anything there that you'd like to make? Chapter 17, an oracle concerning Damascus. Now, if you were in the or on the river Arnon, which direction would you go to get to Damascus? Anybody know off the top of their head?
North, right?
Up, right? North, I mean. Yes, Damascus is the capital of Syria, and it is mostly north, probably just a little bit to the east yet. But the attention is now going toward Damascus, and we find sort of mixed into this oracle about Damascus is the northern tribes of Israel, so Ephraim and those associated with it, because they formed an alliance with Damascus, you may remember, in trying to ward off the invasion of the Assyrian Empire, and they went down together. And so Isaiah sort of groups them together here. Behold, Damascus will cease to be a city, will become a heap of ruins. The cities of Aroer are deserted. They will be for flocks, which will lie down, and none will make them afraid, because there's nobody there but them. The fortress will disappear from Ephraim, and the kingdom from Damascus. And the remnant of Syria will be like the glory of the children of Israel, declares the Lord of hosts. In that day, the glory of Jacob will be brought low, and the fat of his flesh will grow lean. So it's one of those weight loss programs that you don't anticipate and don't look forward to. You're not trying to make happen. You just end up there. And it shall be as when the reaper gathers standing grain, and his arms harvest the ears, and as when one gleans the ears of grain in the valley of Rephaim. Okay, so try to capture this picture. We go all summer and we watch the crops, and they, in a good year, they grow to incredible heights and they start putting on grain. And then the combine comes through. And what do you have? Stubble. Now, in some ways, a combined or a corn picked field is a good sign, because that means that it's in the harvest. But on the other hand, it's a picture of great desolation. A lot of people agonize over timber that has been clear cut. They say, oh, what a mess. But have you ever considered a cornfield? I mean, they just cut everything. They just throw the stubble out. It's a sad sight. At least with timber, there's some sprigs here and there when you're done. But anyway, that was free. In both cases, they will grow back. And especially if you plant them. But it is a kind of a desolate picture. There's nothing going on there at that point. So that's the picture he's giving here. And he continues to extend this to other types of harvest. He says, gleanings will be left in it, as when an olive tree is beaten. Two or three berries in the top of the highest bough. Four or five on the branches of a fruit tree, declares the Lord God of Israel. So the Israelites were encouraged to not harvest everything, to leave gleanings for the poor. But it's a pretty desolate sight. You take a fruit tree or a nut tree or a fig tree that is fully loaded with fruit, and wow, what a picture of bounty. You shake it down, except for a few here and there, and it's pretty scraggly, right? There's not much left at all. And so that is the picture that Isaiah here is using to illustrate the kind of devastation that will be in these formerly well-populated and fruitful areas. In that day, man will look to his Maker, and his eyes will look on the Holy One of Israel. He will not look to the altars, the work of his hands. He will not look on what his own fingers have made, either the Asherim, which refer to a pole, which was used in the worship of the fertility goddess, or the altars of incense, which were used in the worship of Baal. In that day, their strong cities will be like the deserted places of the wooded heights and the hilltops, which they deserted because of the children of Israel. And there will be desolation. Okay, so the high places that the Canaanites used whenever the land was conquered by Israel, during the good periods of Israelite history were vacated and they just grew up. I don't know if you've ever had the experience of visiting an old home site place or an old farm. I mean, like really old, where nobody's been for a long time. But it is amazing how stuff grows back, how fast it grows back. To be honest, out at my sawmill, there are some areas where I have stored equipment for longer, I guess, than I have thought. There's a two-bottom plow out there that has sizable trees growing up through it. It's just unreal how fast that nature tries to reclaim the landscape. And my equipment, yeah. Yeah, it's... I can't just go hook up to it and walk off or drive off. I'm going to have to do some cutting to get it. But it happens. I don't know. It's probably only been there 30 or 40 years. But anyway, there was a time in my life whenever I wanted to have a pretty big garden, and I thought I needed a two-bottom plow, but technology's changed since then. I'd a lot rather have a tiller now on the back of a tractor. But anyway, if you need a two-bottom plow, you look me up. I've got one.
Bring a chainsaw.
Bring a chainsaw. Yes. But anyway, that reminds me of this picture here, these deserted places, the wooded heights and the hilltops. Where at one time there were celebrations and rituals and festivities carried out by many people, they've become deserted. So their strong cities, he says, will look like this. These cities which have high towers and thick walls and look like they should last forever have fallen as the deserted heights. For you have forgotten the Lord, you have forgotten the God of your salvation and have not remembered the rock of your refuge. Therefore, though you plant pleasant plants and sow the vine branch of a stranger, okay, as opposed to holding to the home traditions and plants that have been a part of your past. You import plants from elsewhere. And of course, this is always, in every generation, a temptation. There's a certain attraction to the new that is undeniable. At least at certain points in your life. I confess, just because it's new doesn't attract me as much as it used to. They make new junk too. And if you buy it, if you're lucky, you can fix it. If not, you just have to throw it away. So new isn't always better. Sometimes it's just a pain. But there is undeniably a certain attraction to idealize new. Sometimes you have the feeling, you know, I'm tired of fixing this, I'm just going to get a new one. Because the supposition is that a new one will be better and will help me avoid all the problems I'm experiencing. So this suggestion here of importing things, the strange things, the vine branch of a stranger, though you make them grow on the day that you plant them and make them blossom in the morning that you sow. This is quite a plant. Yet the harvest will flee away in a day of grief and incurable pain. Yeah. That feeling It's kind of one of the things that certain kinds of nightmares are made of. What you're most trying to get is just out of reach, and it's running in the other direction, right? It's fleeing away. So the vine is great if it grows fast, if it blossoms. But if you don't get anything off of it, if there's no harvest, it's not worth the effort. So another way of picturesque speech, isn't Isaiah full of it? All these different ways that illustrate his points. The harvest will flee away in a day of grief and incurable pain. What a contrast to the joy of a plant that grows and blossoms in a day. Ah, the thunder of many peoples. They thunder like the thundering of the sea. Ah, the roar of nations. They roar like the roaring of mighty waters. The nations roar like the roaring of many waters, but he will rebuke them, and they will flee far away, chased like chaff on the mountains before the wind, and whirling dust before the storm. So the power of God, all he has to do is speak. All he has to do is rebuke the efforts and the power of the mighty nations. And they are like chaff on the mountains before the wind. Have you ever seen in person a dust storm like they have out west, Arizona? One time when we were delivering chairs out there, we encountered that. Fortunately, I don't think we were in it that much, but we saw it passing, and it's just a wall of dust kicked up by the wind, whirling dust before the storm. This is a part of the world where they knew about those kind of dust storms. At evening time, behold terror. Before morning, they are no more. So, a destruction simply overnight, that fast. This is the portion of those who loot us, and the lot of those who plunder us. You may remember that there was a period here where Israel allied with the rulers of Damascus to basically inflict harm and invade Judah. So they were fighting with their own brethren because they would not join in their efforts against Assyria at that time. Okay, there's, goodness, we've done two chapters in Isaiah one day. This section of Isaiah, where he has these multiple burdens against these various entities, kind of are pretty much in this vein of a highly figurative, symbolic language. Not a lot of specific markers that tell you the time or date of events. These aren't things that we can absolutely say this was fulfilled specifically here and now. They're more conceptual in that Isaiah's intent is to show God as in control of all things, to show God as the one who is moving history and moving the forces of history. So, whereas, at least on the surface, we tend to think of prophecy about finding out what's going to happen, right? I want to know what's going to happen and when. Well, the prophet is also very intent on communicating a worldview, communicating the nature of God and the way he works in the world. And In Isaiah's case, that's probably more his interest than the other. We've got a few minutes left. Chapter 18. Ah, land of whirring wings that is beyond the rivers of Cush. Okay, so normally Egypt is known as a land of whirring wings because of all the flying bugs that are there. Kind of like Florida. Nobody here to peep a protest. But anyway, there are a lot of bugs in warm places sometimes. I don't suppose that would be true in the Sahara, but warm places that have some water. So around the Nile, you have a lot of bugs. Land of Cush refers to what we would now call Ethiopia. And there was a period of time here in Isaiah's lifetime when the Ethiopians ruled Egypt. And so he's turning his view now to the world of Egypt. He says, which sends ambassadors by the sea in vessels of papyrus on the waters. Go, you swift messengers, to a nation tall and smooth, to a people feared near and far, a nation mighty and conquering, whose land the waters divide. Okay, so I'm reading the ESV this morning. I don't know if you noticed that, but it's much easier to follow, at least in this section of Isaiah. The downside is it's not linked to my language aid, so I can't put a cursor on a word and find things. But I found the translation of this tall and smooth quite funny in some other translations. For instance, I'm in the wrong verse. One more. In the King James, it's to a nation scattered and peeled. Instead of tall and smooth. I don't know if you've ever thought of somebody who is smooth as being peeled, but I suppose, you know, you take a peach, it's a little bit fuzzy on the outside, you peel it, and it's smooth. So there you go. Doesn't work for apples, but onion, carrots, there you are. So this is, I think, a way of talking about the tall Ethiopians. They are tall and smooth. All ye inhabitants of the world, you who dwell on the earth, when a signal is raised on the mountains, look. When a trumpet is blown, hear. Okay, so you've heard of an early warning system. They had it a long time ago. They didn't do it electronically, but they got up on a high place where they could project their voice for a long ways, blew a trumpet, different ways of getting out the word that something's going on.
Keith?
Yes?
This brings back a memory. When I was a GPS, there was an Ethiopian. They called him Smoothie because he couldn't grow facial hair.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay. There you have. Wouldn't that be nice not to have to shave? There's advantages to everything, I suppose. Unless you need to stay warm in the winter.
Probably not a problem in Ethiopia.
That's true. That's true. Not a problem. Any other memories out there you'd like to share with us? Keep this interesting. So he says, look, listen. For thus the Lord said to me, I will quietly look from my dwelling, like clear heat in sunshine, like a cloud of dew in the heat of harvest. For before the harvest, when the blossom is over, and the flower becomes a ripening grape, he cuts off the shoots with pruning hooks, and the spreading branches he lops off and clears away. They shall all of them be left to the birds of prey of the mountains and to the beasts of the earth. And the birds of prey will summer on them, and all the beasts of the earth will winter on them. Okay, so what do we have here? We have, he's describing during his lifetime, the Egyptians, during a period of Assyrian weakness, were running up and down the land of the Middle East, trying to generate a bigger and bigger coalition against Assyria. So they were, by means of gathering numbers to their coalition, trying to amass a resistance to the Assyrians. And so one of the temptations for the land of Judah always was to become a part of these movements. Isaiah was always one who says, no, you should trust in God. God's in control of the bigger picture. He's the one that you can depend on, not your walled cities, not your alliances with foreigners. You should trust in the Lord. And so here he pictures this activity going on. And he pictures the Lord as saying, I'm watching the whole thing. I see it going down. And this pruning of the ripening fruit, you don't normally do that, right? You prune the vines when they're dormant, before they're flowering and bearing fruit. This is a disaster. Okay, this is not a good picture. And so all this fruit that's being anticipated as being the harvest ends up being left to the birds of prey and to the beasts of the earth. Because the Lord is watching the whole thing, is in control of all. So that's the picture we see developing here at the first part of chapter 18. Well, according to my timepiece, trying not to be a hired man here, it is time, so the bell has rung. Thank you for your kind attention. Thank you.
Shorty, oh.